Hello everyone, Tony here, and I'm letting you know that Dwayne and I will be taking Tree Actions live on March 27th and 28th of this year. We will be at Arbor Expo at the New Jersey Convention and Exposition Center in Edison, New Jersey. Come join us for the tree industry's fastest growing trade show and conference. This year features 19 education sessions, two of which I will be delivering, as well as all the exhibitors and demos you can expect from an excellent trade show and conference. We will look forward to seeing you there.
All right, everybody, welcome to another episode of Tree Actions, the Human Forestry Podcast. My name is Dwayne Neustadter, and joining me as always is my trusted co-host and technical expert, Tony Trussell. And joining us on today's episode is Matt Vinette, all the way from Winnipeg, Manitoba. How is it going today, Matt?
Very well, gentlemen. Probably a lot colder than you guys, but yeah, very well from the prairies, from Winnipeg.
Yeah, I guess I should say, you know, this is, we're actually recording today's session, the Christmas week. It is, well, I guess a week, it's 1 week, 7 days. It's next Monday is Christmas, so we're the Monday eve of Christmas Eve. So it is the season, so I hope everyone had a good Christmas. But this Matt episode will probably air only in March. We always start off as a way of introductions as to ask our guests what their first recollection or memory is of when they first connected or have a memory of having a meaningful experience with a tree or trees.
I'd have to say, you know, when I first discovered this job or discovered arboriculture, I thought it was so cool because I really had a connection with trees, like living in a real rural area when I was a kid. And our only pastime was building tree forts and tree swings in these trees where we lived along this river. So it was really big deal. Everyone had a tree fort, and the goal was to wreck the other guy's fort. So when your gang discovered another fort, you'd tell the rest of the gang, and then you'd go wreck that fort. And then they got higher and higher. It seemed to me when I was 10 that it was really high, but maybe it was 20 feet. I don't know. But we used to build these giant swings way up in the tree. We'd, you know, nail these boards to trees, unfortunately, but swing around in trees. And then when I learned how to climb and do things, I was like, oh, well, this is really cool. It's kind of like when I was a kid. But I was always interested in trees, though. When I first got into the business and went to school and so on, I dug out all this stuff I had about trees, all these books and everything I had about trees. I had this whole Life magazine about the whole thing was about trees from like 1978, something like that. And then I had this whole book about the redwoods, because I went there when I was a kid with my parents, and that totally fascinated me. But I never realized I could make a connection till I accidentally got into the business and then backed into going to post-secondary school.
Wow. So do you think that played a role in you somehow finding it, like energetically or subconsciously finding your way into actually arboriculture?
Yeah. When I first started doing it, I looked back at all the things like that I really was interested in trees. I didn't realize how interested I was. Till I started doing it, and especially climbing. And I think every climber I've ever met has that day when they're up in a tree and they go, oh my gosh, getting paid to do this, like what the heck.
So tell us about that day as much as you can remember, when that occurred for you, when you had that holy cow moment.
Oh, well, I remember I was like downtown, middle of winter, you know, like we climb trees here. Like, I mean, we climb trees here minus 30, and always the goal is get in the tree, just get in so you can start working. And then once you get in and you're moving around, minus 30 is fine to people on the prairies, believe it or not. But it's that getting in part, that initial getting in part, which is the tricky part. You know, you put everything on in the truck, get all set, then you go get everything on, then you go throw in, and then get in. But I remember being downtown, climbing this big cottonwood that kind of went over the entire street, and I was just up at the top, and it was sunny, crisp, freezing day, and I just sat up there and looked around, went, wow, getting paid to do this. Someone made a mistake, because I'd do it for free.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think a lot of artists have that, at least one, or, you know, probably more than once it happens, where you can't believe that, you know, not only the location you're in, you know, typically it's an aerial position, but that you're being paid to do it, and you'd probably do it for nothing if you knew it was something that needed doing. You know, I think there's something about that too. You hear people talk about this, you know, the whole quest for going, where like the Star Trek thing, boldly going where no one has gone before, right? Like, and in a tree that often happens, you know, you're maybe the first one ever to be at that height in that tree. And there's something about that, I think, that's quite attractive to people.
Oh yeah. Yeah, for sure. We're still kind of a secret occupation, right? I mean, how many times do you meet someone even now that arboriculture is so huge and it's so much more widely known because of the internet than it was before. But I mean, I think I met someone last week that had to explain what an arborist was, and they're like, and what I do. And then as you're explaining it, you go, wow, it's still pretty cool. Like, it's still a pretty cool job.
Yeah, I find I have an extra layer of complexity, because people ask me the same thing, obviously. They know, so are you like a tree cutter guy thing? Like, is that, that's what your company does? And it's like, well, yeah, but we train people. What? Because, you know, we don't do the work per se, but we train people that do the work. And that's even harder to get people's heads through, like, what? Train? What? But you do tree cutting. Yeah, kind of.
Yeah. No, I mean, even describing a TCC to people, which you have to do all the time, right? When you're talking to media, no one knows what you're talking about. And they just, to them, it's like, oh, yeah, you're the steel timber sports guys. You spike up and then as fast as you can. Oh, I know what you're doing.
Yeah. yeah, it's like, yeah, no, not exactly. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Well, you know, you've been involved with TCC. You're currently the Prairie Chapter TCC chair. When did your career in the tree climbing competition begin?
Oh, well, you know, I only competed twice. I completed once. I was never much of a competitor, but I competed twice.
You did, okay.
Yeah, Winnipeg and one more. First time when I brought Jesse into it. Kicking and screaming, by the way. Like, had to force him and pay him for the day and pay for everything and pay for gear. So I was really not much of a competitor. And then I've been a volunteer since, you know, for, I don't know, 15 years, I've been off and on doing it. And then I became the chair after we had a series of really badly organized TCCs. And I'd been to the internationals for so many years, a couple of years volunteering with your crew. And I just thought we could do it better on the prairies. And I think our comp in the last, you know, 7-8 years has really improved a lot, and we've made a lot of leaps and bounds with it. I'm pretty proud of what our comp on the prairies has become.
I agree. You know, you mentioned Jesse, who is our longest winning TCC champion in history, and he used to work for you and work for you when you basically paid him to go in his first competition. But what I've always noticed about yourself in particular, and I wanted to ask you, you know, you've brought a lot of people into the industry, and you seem to have almost a fearless or open willingness to bring virtually anyone in that's got a heartbeat and pulse and expresses any kind of a desire. Like, you're willing to take that risk with people. And I'm, you know, you've done it once as a favor to me for someone I knew, and, you know, they don't all work out. But what is it? 'Cause not everyone is that willing, Matt. Why do you have that, where does that come from for you? 'Cause I've always found it fascinating.
I don't know. I'd like punishment, I guess. I mean, that's true. Guilty as charged. I really enjoy getting people in this business and seeing people who went from it being a part-time job or a stopgap measure to being fully invested in the business. And I think there's a, you know, there's certain type of folks that are willing to do that, because I think everybody I know in the business, like, especially with ISA and the TCC, like, we're one big family, and I so look forward to seeing my family all the time, because it's a certain type. I think once you get to a certain level, it's not it's your life. It's more than a job. I mean, I hardly do anything in my spare time or on my vacations that are not tree related or related to something. And I just meet a lot of people from walks of life. And even now, lots of our, I could name you most of our competitors in this business in Manitoba anyway, worked here. And even at the city of Winnipeg, I mean, most of the people there in a lot of positions started here with us. I don't know why I do it. I mean, I love trees a lot. I love seeing someone get into the business. And we've been doing, ISA has been doing our booth at the Green Show every winter, so we get a lot of students coming from Red River, and I'm really proud that I have turned so many students who didn't know what they were going to do in horticulture, that I've turned them to arboriculture, whether it was through here or other places.
Well, and that's another part of it that I've admired about you, Matt, is that you not only do that and are willing to take risks with people and bring them on and with gusto, like you make someone feel welcome and wanted, but then so many people have gone through your organization, or they've known you, they've got their start with you, and then they go on, and you only encourage that too. You know, I've never heard you complain that, oh yeah, hire that guy, train him up just so he can go start to compete against me. Like you know, and some people, you know, get jaded by that. But I've never observed that in you. What do you contribute that to? Like, 'cause that's a unique quality that is a lot of employers share.
Well, thanks. I appreciate the comment. But I mean, I guess it goes back to like when we all first started, you as well. But I remember when I first started doing it, there were so few of us in this industry. and I joke around. I was joking to my wife the other night about one of our competitors who I say, I turned him. I remember he came to the Cutter conference in 91 and he was a tree cutter, one-handing on the saw, and he was free climbing, and got him to join Trees Winnipeg, and he joined ISA, and now he's one of the respected people in the business. So even though he's a competitor, we helped turn him into a good one.
Yeah, well, that's another thing I that you just jogged my memory on. I've observed also is where you've taken under your wing, so to speak, and hired people that you know, because of their history and where they've worked, that they've probably developed some habits that aren't going to really work on your cruise, but you take them on and show them the way and embrace it. And, you know, there's a few growing pains along the way, but you do that as well. It's not like you just take newbies and say, here's how it's done. You'll take, you know, people that maybe didn't have the opportunity to learn some of the things they maybe should have, and say, yeah, come on over here. We'll see how we do things. You know, you've done that as well.
Yeah, and I think when people come here, they realize it's a different world, and we spend a lot of money on training and certification. I know there's people that will put through training and certification, and a year later they're gone on to something else. But it's never gonna stop us from doing it. Because in the long run, it's a good investment for everything. We just had our Christmas party for all our supervisors on Friday, and we're going around the table talking to everybody, and we had two people there. We called them our rescues. That we rescued them from other companies, and one guy we had to. I think you know who I'm talking about. He's one of the best volunteers at the TCC in Arbor Day, but. Yeah. One guy, we had to like tie his hand behind his back so he couldn't one hand on the saw, and then we banned him from using top handle saw. We just gave him a 190 so he couldn't use the top handle saw and one hand it.
Yeah. No, I know exactly what you're talking about, and it's been an amazing transformation, really. And I'm not that he was morally depraved or anything. It was just he didn't know and never been shown a different way. And you took the time to do that. And you know, I've invested in that individual, and it's reaped. You know, I think he would say that it's changed his life or impacted his life in a positive way.
Yeah. We've had employees and climbers come here. They worked somewhere, one of our guys worked somewhere else for a decade. And he was an awesome climber. You know, he had some corrections to be made, but he didn't even know that Arbor Day existed in Winnipeg and Trees Winnipeg existed, or he didn't even know that tree climbing competitions existed. Just had no idea. Lived in this like isolated little tree arb world.
Huh. Yeah. Well, and I think that there's a lot of arborists out there like that. You know, there is, even with the internet and the social media the way it is, there's still a lot that don't know even locally what's going on. A thought just came to me, and I think it may have vanished. That happens in my age now. I'm thinking about the human forest, and we call this the Human Forestry Podcast, and you know, you're, you know, as far as you know, there's, you've heard it said about trees in the forest that help other trees. You know, they call them, you know, the mother trees, I think is what Suzanne Simard calls them. You know, maybe you're a father tree, but trees are a great example of uninhibited support for each other. And I think even interspecies, that's been proven. And, you know, it just, as you were talking and sharing it, that's an example came to mind of, you know, your tree in this human forest has been significantly in providing, you know, growth and help, energy for new and other arborists that join and interconnect with your forest. It's pretty cool.
It is little seedlings.
Yeah, those, exactly.
We throw them about.
Yeah. Well, we always ask people and talk a little bit about what your thoughts are on how you feel trees and being part of the tree world has, you know, not only affected your career and affected you professionally, but do you think or can you think of ways or share with us ways that trees have affected you personally in your personal life, whatever you're willing to share on that level?
Oh yeah. I mean, absolutely. I don't know if I'm that different from lots of people in the business, but people tell me that I am different. When I drive around with my wife, who's just become an arborist by osmosis, I'm always getting her to ID trees, and we'll be going somewhere at someone's house, and I'll say, "Oh, it's pull up right here, it's right by that basswood," and she'll say, "You know, you can identify houses by numbers. You know, that's how other people do it." But I'm proud to say, like, my, you know, everyone in my family is very tree centric, because I really encourage it with them. When my daughter was young, I used to give her $1 for every tree she would ID on our walks. And she was in the tree business for a while. She's not anymore. She's in the insurance business. But she was honored this past Arbor Day as having 25 years of service at Trees Winnipeg Arbor Day. She's been a volunteer there like since she was like 3 years old.
Wow.
And my son's in the business, and lots of my friends that came to work, you know, for me maybe for a short period of time, have turned into arborists, like more than I can even count. Are in the business now, and lots of them competitors.
Yeah.
But, yeah. You know, people that, I mean, our Arbor Day that we have here, that involves really all the good companies in Winnipeg. And we have the 27th Arbor Day in Winnipeg this year, but people always marvel at it because every company in Winnipeg is involved. No one puts their logo out or anything. It's just very, the day is for trees, or the 2 days. No one puts their logo out, and there is at least 15 companies in Winnipeg, and everybody who comes, I remember Brent Pancharski from Hydro came this year for the first time, and he was like, "This is unbelievable that all these competitors are here. You could never get a bunch of plumbers together and put on plumbing day or whatever and have them all come together. They'd be all fighting each other." But our Arbor Day is really, in Winnipeg, it's the it's our reunion every year. Everyone gets together. We have the really important part of it is our big party afterwards, and the Arb Canada Spirit of Arbor Day Award. And it's really the biggest, I mean, it's an event for the public in Winnipeg, but it's also the event that brings all the Winnipeg arborists together.
Well, then I find that event, it's unique. You know, there isn't a lot like it, and there's all sorts of Arbor Day events. But one thing about that event is, unlike the competition, is that there isn't a competitive atmosphere whatsoever. It's all about helping. It's all about trees and working together. And maybe just like how did the whole thing evolve? Because you guys have quite a unique thing going there, and it's been going on for a long time. So you not only have you develop something unique, but you have sustainability.
The first one was organized. The very first one was organized by Martha when she was the executive director of Trees Winnipeg. She organized the first one. We met like the day before in the arboretum of Assiniboine Park, like threw together what we were going to do, and it just grew from there. Now it takes months of planning and like 2 full-time staff to do it and over 100 volunteers to run the event. But back when we first started doing, we had a couple of trees that we did tree climbing demonstrations, and for like 4 years we did an aerial rescue demonstration. And after a few years we went, why are we doing this? Like, people are coming to this Arbor Day thing and they're going to watch us rescue an arborist, and then they go, oh well, if I hire an arborist, this is what I can come to expect. Someone's going to have to come rescue the poor guy from the tree. So we cut out that event. But now it's like it's a huge event. We incorporated it with the Trees Winnipeg Re-Leaf event, where we distribute trees to the public, and we generally distribute about 100 trees, 1,000 trees during the event. And at the same time, Arbor Day is going on, where we have about 7 different events: bucket truck rides, kids climbing rides, tree planting demos, and booths with NCOs. And it's a really big event now, and people come year after year. And there's so many people that are in the business now or in another kind of discipline that discover trees at Arbor Day. I still have people come like 15 years later are still coming, and they're involved somehow with trees from coming to our event.
So it's almost like, would you say almost like a carnival type atmosphere that's annual? Like, people look forward to the event, and like, do that, like, people like, I've been taking this ride for, cause you know, you almost have like, you have rides and you have activities and things for all ages, really. Correct? Is that fair to say?
Yeah. Oh, for sure. There's lots of people that come every year, but we move it around the city and try to make it in a neighborhood park. So this year we had it in Crescent Drive Park, which is a really cool kind of secluded park that has, well, you were there. That's where we had the tree climbing competition as well, but yeah, we held Arbor Day there as well. So it's a really well-used community park, and people just kind of, they either knew or they just were walking through their park that day and discovered it. And, you know, even if 3 people came away with an appreciation for trees from that, I think we succeeded.
Yeah, and do you move around because you do like actual tree work at the park, which kind of helps with the urban forest maintenance, or is it just to get people at different places?
Yeah, we just want to spread the message around. I mean, for sure, we do good for the parks because we prune a lot of the trees and point out a lot of things, but. City of Winnipeg Forestry has been our partner since the very, very beginning. So they're a huge part of helping us get the park and organize logistics and that sort of thing. But it's a lot of volunteer companies. In Crescent Drive Park, for instance, we pruned about 20-something really ugly trees in anticipation for Arbor Day and for the TCC. So about 7 or 8 companies were involved in the day that we did it, and bucket trucks and climbers and all donated times, and we cleaned up all the trees for them.
So what do you think it is about that type of event that lets companies put their competitive edge aside and, you know, lay down their swords and pick up the plowshares, so to speak, and work together for those couple of days, and even, you know, some to prepare for it and give of their time. What makes that happen? How does that, why are they willing to do it?
I think it's like, well, it's camaraderie for one. It's a couple of days you get to spend with your peers and meet new people. And we've had a lot of companies that have been doing this since the very start. Our company and Jesse and Carla's company, Trilogy, they're a huge part of it. They pretty much organize the whole thing with us. A lot of people have been doing it for years, and it really look forward to it. When we're sitting around the day before, we always call the day before Arbor Day is Arbor Eve. It's like our, it's like the big deal, like the day before Christmas. But we have a big gathering before it all kicks off, and all the volunteers are there for a big photo, and it's 100+ volunteers all wearing the same Arbor Day shirt, which is really cool. We hold a contest every year at a school. So we'll invite the school to be our Arbor Day school. And we hold a contest in the classrooms for the t-shirt art that goes on the t-shirt. And then we pick a winner, that art goes on the front of the shirt. And then we invite the student to Arbor Day. They're the guest of honor for the day. They get to go to the front of the line, and then we plant tree at that school with the whole school involved, and we teach them about the care of the tree and so on. Then they have an Arbor Day tree, and then the following year that art is used on our promotional material from the student who made it, and then we have a new one that's on the shirt every year.
Oh,
so the involvement is really cool, and we try every year, or at least I do. I do a lot of recruiting and get companies like, come on, send some of your employees out. And sometimes it takes years to get them to finally come because they don't understand what it is. And once you get them to come, though, they're hooked. They're there forever. But I think a lot of companies, through their involvement with Arbor Day and TCC and meeting like-minded people, like became really good. I'd say responsible companies and grew as arborists from being a part of these things.
It's fascinating. And you know, you do see it happen. And it doesn't happen everywhere. And I sometimes, you know, wonder what it is that just the right combination of people and energy that can make something, you know, like this, when it is and then last. And I don't know exactly what it is, but when you know, when you're in it, that it's real and you want to be a part of it, it's infectious, you know? We've only been, you know, we've been a supporter of it, but we have never actually, I've never actually attended it because I'm busy and everything else. But after talking to you now and listening more about it, I think I should maybe try to go this year just to come to one, like fly in for it, you know? It's always in the summer, isn't it?
It's the first Saturday every June.
Yeah.
First Saturday in June.
Might have to actually show up for one. You know, do you get anyone like that, or is it really just the city of Winnipeg? Do you have people that actually come to it from out of town?
No, it's definitely, I can't think of anybody that comes from out of town. It's definitely Winnipeg thing. Is not unlike the TCC where, you know, oh my God, everyone comes from all over. It's definitely a Winnipeg thing.
But the TCC doesn't gather the local crowd in the same way, I don't think, does it?
No, I don't think so.
No. Well, everyone, no. If you're listening, if you've got an inclination to go to Winnipeg the first Saturday in June, you too can be part of this magical event known as Arbor Day, which is not it's not your usual average Arbor Day. And I think I might have to just take it in. There we go, Tony. We got a on location tree actions maybe cooking here.
No, I'm totally down with that. I know that park because I was there just after, because we did the training course for the city of Winnipeg, just a couple weeks after the TCC was there. So I was working with the city guys in that park on some aerial lift rescue and pruning and rigging, and yeah, it was a beautiful park.
It is.
Yeah. It's really, a lot of the trees are like what I would call naturalized, because a couple of the trees we used in the TCC and in Arbor Day, I mean, I don't think they'd ever been touched or pruned. They were natural, really low to the ground. I mean, we didn't alter any of that. But it had like lower branches really low to the ground. And it's also a good park because I think Dwayne's done the hazard course there before, because I think there's no shortage of, uh, of hazard trees in that park.
Quite a range, and lots of nice old mature trees too, in various stages of condition. So you can see a real spectrum of, and then you also have the river so close, and also kind of naturalized areas. So you can see the differences in soil conditions and how trees respond to, you know, to impacts and so on. It's a great training venue, and it is somewhat a bit out of the way. You know, it's not on a main, it's kind of at the end of a road sort of thing, you know?
Yeah. You have to really know how to, you have to be going there. You won't just drive by.
No, you won't accidentally find it unless you're lost.
It was a really, really well used, neighborhood park. The neighborhood, gets a lot of use out of that park, which made it great for both those events.
Well, you know, it's been well documented, as you know, that trees are important to communities, and, you know, we as people are highly connected to them for lots of different reasons. And, you know, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't just chat a little bit about our recent experience, because Matt and I both were in Hong Kong at the same time for the Hong Kong conference, and Matt spoke at the conference, as did I, and I was there doing a tree appraisal talk and then a course. But some of the trees we saw in Hong Kong, Matt, were pretty cool. You know, and what I was impressed by there, which is the same as in Winnipeg, I think, is the connection that people had to the trees. You know, certainly our students, but the, you know, that there is attention to trees. And quite, I don't know how to put it, like the government's even involved, so to speak, you know, in the trees there, like that gentleman we met at the park when we were looking at his trees.
Yeah, I think they have intense connection with trees there. They don't have as many as a lot of places in North America or Europe, for that matter, because it's just such so densely populated. They don't have a lot, but what they do have, they really look after, like, to an amazing degree. Every tree, every public tree gets inspected every year, and I think there's like about a couple thousand kilometers of cobra cable in Hong Kong. They sure seem to like that, but they pay a lot of attention to the trees. And I've never been to a city where there was so many trees with tags on them, and they were just so well inspected, and they had the trees that the OVTs, remember they called them the old valuable trees, and the wall trees, and that tree we saw, that banyan tree we saw at the basketball court, where part of it failed onto the court, and and if that happened here, that tree would be gone the next day. But in Hong Kong, they went, well, the tree failed, so everybody stay away from the tree now. And they built that huge barricade to protect the tree and from the tree falling instead of removing it, which I thought was just remarkable. Yeah.
And they took up 3/4 of the seating, half the seating, and just tough greens, you know, nobody can sit anymore. They put this cage around it. I couldn't tell if they were trying to keep people away from the tree or the tree from getting away, but it worked either way.
The tree cages they had, the one that you were that you broke into and were in the tree cage to peep people out, and they had like 3/4-inch aircraft cable holding the tree up so people wouldn't, I guess people wouldn't steal it, but to support the tree, of course. And they move a lot of trees there. They unlike here, I mean, there's, you know, if a tree needs to go for development, you just need to pay for it and you can take it out. But there's like, no, we're not removing the tree. We're going to move it. And they move these giant trees. It's amazing.
Well, that one tree that we looked at, that Mike was telling us about, they actually built a rail, like a mini railroad, so they, because it was so heavy, they and they took so much soil with it that they, and then cabled it along the rail, like 300 meters to its new location. Like, it's just an unbelievable effort to move that. And the tree's still alive. And it was, that was what, 10 years ago or more. It's like, obviously going to survive its move. And, yeah, I was quite fascinated by it as well. Anyone that's ever considered going to Hong Kong or not, you would be pleasantly surprised to find some incredibly unique trees there. You may not think it, but they're definitely there.
Oh, yeah. I found it striking. A couple of the roads we went down, the road we went down on the way to Victoria, to Victoria Park, where you took me, where you did the appraisal, like those trees, there was like 150-foot tall trees over completely over the road with, you know, 200-centimeter DBH trunks. Just, I don't know how you manage those. It's utterly nutty.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. That was in Kowloon Park. Yeah. But, you know, it just goes to show you that the value trees have and the connection people have to them is, you know, for me, it expanded my concept into, I always talked about it and knew about it, but then when you see it in practice in a quite a different culture and country, you know, I'd never been to Hong Kong before, so it was a new experience for me, and it was refreshing, like you say, to see the amount of attention that was paid to the, and what's also interesting is that nobody owns the dang trees, you know, and I wonder how much that had to do with it. Like, it almost gave the trees a public, it was like a public utility. It was like, because very few trees are on a property that someone actually owns. Whereas, you know, we have this concept here that we own them, right? And I guess we do because they're on the land, but you know, that I always think about how the First Nations, you know, thought it was crazy that these white colored people were coming here saying they're going to own this land, you know, because in First Nation culture, the land owns us, you know, we don't own the land, and let alone the trees, and there nobody owns it. So it's not one person's tree, you know, it's everybody's tree. And maybe that's why they get the protection they get, you know, and I found that the most stark difference that I experienced when I was there, especially teaching tree appraisal, because the tree appraisal model that we have in North America is based on ownership. You know, you own the tree, and there, what's my tree worth? You know, there it's like, well, this, you know, it was interesting because as we started valuing trees, they're like, but these trees are worth so much more than that. It's not just money. They're connected to it in a different way because everyone owns a little piece of it because it's part of the city or community. I think it's a neat way of looking at it. Very unique.
Oh yeah, definitely. There's only a handful of places that look at trees in that regard. And I definitely got that sense there talking to people and looking at trees that they feel they all are part of the trees. And to do their culture too, which is, you know, really different than ours.
Very different. And, you know, I guess we're getting a bit on a Hong Kong tangent here, but I also found, and, you know, when I think of the human forest, you know, I found the human forest there to be a lot of order, organized congestion. You know, there's so many people moving in and out of trains and cabs and buildings and restaurants, and like there's such an organism moving around, but yet everyone respected space. There wasn't shoving or pushing. There was, I mean, people would get tighter when they had to on a train, but as soon as there was space, they'd give that space. And they, even within the tight space, there was a respect of each other's. I found that, at least myself, and you know, very much like a forest is, you know, like you look at a tree's canopy, they're never encroaching one against the other. They're making room for each other. And I saw it more exemplified in human behavior there than I ever have before in any other city.
Oh,
I
mean, yeah. You experienced that a lot. Agreed. I can totally relate some very similar stories to that as well.
Yeah, I think, it's another one of those examples, I think, how trees, to me, really are an example of, in many ways, of how we could live. And if we all interacted with each other the way trees interact with one another in the forest, in where they live, you know, not only connected to one another above underground, but giving space for each other above ground, just a great example of how we as a society could probably get along better. I don't know. You ever thought about that?
Yeah, treat each other like trees. yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Tony, have you ever been, I know you've been traveled and a little bit. I don't know if you've been to Hong Kong.
No, I haven't been in that part of the world. I think it would be fascinating. I wonder if the respect from the trees is derived from the fact that, you know, they have to take up so much space, where space is such a premium. You almost have to grant them a little bit of respect, you know, you'd have to value them differently. You know what I mean? And it takes time to fill that space. It's not, you know, I mean, there's buildings that take up more space than a tree, but they don't revere their buildings like they revere trees, you know? So I wonder if it's the, and it, you know, and it's such a built up area, you know, if it, those little tiny slivers of nature, I think might add some of the value into it too. But it's, I think it would be very interesting. I mean, can you even call it a tree appraisal, right? Like, don't you really almost have to change the name, because it's appraisal, yeah, almost has dollar signs after it, right? Like, there's almost a currency marker with it. You almost have to call it a tree, not an evaluation, but a, you know, there's got to be a word somewhere for adding, you know,
a tree appreciation.
Yeah, exactly. An appreciative value, right? And like, which is kind of funny, yeah, in and of itself, because, well, it grows, but that's a whole nother play on words.
That was very interesting, because during the course, it's a theme that arose, and in the current model, you know, the popular model of trunk formula method, there's a depreciation. So you have your unadjusted value, and then you have your depreciated value, and everything is, and they really struggle with that as a class, because they say, well, what about, where do we appreciate the tree? What about the quality that it's so old and it's an OVT and where it is, and where do we put that and reflect that? Well, in really all you did is you don't deduct it as much. I said, yeah, but where do we appreciate it, not just depreciate? So we depreciate, the way you recognize it was by depreciating it less, which just made no sense. You know, well, we'll depreciate you less because we like you.
Well, yeah, yeah. Less depreciation equals more, yeah, equals more value. And then how do you put a value on something priceless?
Exactly. Which has always, to me, been the real conundrum of tree appraisal is, you know, you're putting price value on a living thing. And yet insurance companies value lives with life insurance, right? And they actually have ways of deriving what,
yeah, what you're,
it's
worth.
Astonishing.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's, so to them, it's not that hard to say you can value a tree, but
it reminds me a lot of the conversation we had a couple of weeks ago with Jeff Dice, with the tree appraisal program that they had at State College, where they basically just had a list, yeah, of trees, and I don't remember if they called them legacy trees or whatever, but they were on this list because their value is greater than just, yeah, the monetary, or, you know, it's aesthetics or whatever. It somehow symbolized, yeah, the history and significance of the school itself. And I think that in Hong Kong, it seems like they've just done that naturally. Like they've just done that. And like I said, you almost have to have a spot for that in a true tree, you know, evaluation, because they do have meaning, right? Like, I mean, I've done, you know, made a poor cut or a mistaken cut on, you know, the world's crappiest tree, but it was the client, and they planted it when their daughter was born, and there was just all kinds of significance to this. And arboriculturally, it was the best cut. Culturally, it was terrible, you know, which has more value, right? Because, you know, it was the one branch that stuck out in front of the bay window and it bloomed every year. It was like a native dogwood and she just loved seeing it. And it's like, arboriculturally, that branch should go. It's structurally unsound. But culturally, that branch needed to stay. And how can I say that, you know, as an arborist, that my cut's better than that? It's like, so you almost have to have that spot. on it for a tree, or it's not, you're not valuing the tree, right?
Yeah, I've often said that. Yeah, well, I've often said, I used to say to my classes when I taught at the college, you know, arboriculture is not just caring for the trees, it's caring for the people that have the trees too. And finding, like, residential commercial arboriculture particularly is really finding that blend. Well, even utility to some degree, how can you prune the tree to give it, and so it accommodates its location here with the wires or with the porch or with the house or with the, and meet the needs of both parties without compromising one or the other too much, you know, and explaining the, you know, what's best for both and finding ways to make that fit. I think that to me is something all good arborists figure out at some point without maybe specifically identifying it as a skill, but it certainly is.
And then, you know, you almost have to take, you know, Shigo's tree associates along with it, you know, in a setting like that in Hong Kong, how many other things depend on that tree that add value to the whole, right? So why shouldn't there be a box for that, you know, especially in that setting where, you know, trees are not a dime a dozen, right? Like any tree loss is significant to all the associates of trees, not just to the human interaction, but, you know, where are the birds going to sit? Where are these things going to happen?
I mentioned birds and Matt, I don't know if I told you about the parrots. There's a specific species of parrots in these trees that Matt was talking about in this park. And when we were there with the class, and for some reason, they're normally not out as much in the daytime, but they were out and they said, you're really lucky to even see them because usually you have to come here at night to see them. And, but there they were, and there's this unique species of parrot that lives in these trees. And if they were to go, like, I don't know, that, like, it would be a problem, not only from the trees' perspective, the people that love the trees, but the people love that the parrots are there too, and they're connected, and they're wild parrots. They're not owned by anybody. They're also, you know, but there you go. Who owns the parrots and the birds? Like, that seems ludicrous as well. Like, we've not figured out a way yet to say those are my birds.
Well, it makes me kind of wonder, Dwayne, if you could do a tree appraisal in that style on a dead tree, and it would still have value, right? Like
absolutely.
Like, why does the tree have to be alive to have value? Like, why can't you do a tree appraisal like that on a dead tree?
Well, and it's been said, you know, trees, the existence of a tree, its lifespan isn't just its living time period. Because, and this is what I find, even in this model of the human forest that we talk about, those that have, like Norm Hall recently passing, like his legacy, you know, if we use the analogy of a tree falling in the forest, that trunk and those branches decomposing and breaking down in the cavities and the nesting areas that are created, the habitat that's created just by a massive log laying on the ground is for all kinds of species for years on. And how long it would take from that seedling germinating until its tree's grown and fallen and has been finally recycled or decomposed back into soil is an astonishing amount of time. We're talking hundreds of years in most cases. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think we've also lost sight of that in our sterility of the environment and cleanup. You know, cleanup can be taken a little too far, and we just, oh, it's down, cut it up, haul it away, mulch it, grind it. You know, Shigo would often talk about, it's one of the major problems that with the forests, the wild forests, not the urban forests, but is the logging took so much energy away because the wood was taken out. And that wood in the natural state would never just be removed. It would be burned, maybe, but there's a recyclative process to that. Whereas when we log, we take all that energy out of the soil that went into that tree and we move it and take it somewhere, and it's erected in homes and buildings all across the nation. But there's energy sitting in every building that's made of wood. It's just sitting there, not back in the cycle of what this planet would normally have, you know, where it would rotate through somehow. And so it's dormant energy sitting in under gyprock and mortar and brick. I got a little on a tangent there. Sorry, I don't even know what I'm talking about now. I went right off.
I got to move into some made of brick. Wait, my house is made of brick. I'm good.
Well, as you can see, Matt, it's a conversation that we have. But tree appraisal, yeah, that is a big one. And that reference I made about birds. How is it? Like, no one thinks they own the deer that walk through their property, or the fox that runs random once in a while through the, or the birds that come and feed on your trees. They're not your birds. They're not. So why is it that we think we can own the trees? But we do. We seem to apply that ownership to them, right? Because I guess they're attached to the land and they don't fly around.
Well, I often think when you're talking about appraisals, that you can at least educate someone, you know, the careless developer or someone that trees have value. Because I've been approached, yeah. I'm sure you guys all have, by so many insurance companies. We're doing, we're managing a claim for someone and they want a price. They want a price to just replace trees. And then nothing is taken into account that the tree had value. This client we recently did one where Rogers just came on his property, put up a tower, and they removed a whole bunch of old, really old oaks, and they were just going to pay to replace them. And I talked to the client, and I said, well, that's like if your house burns down, they're going to offer to take away the debris for you. Like, you need a new house. So then it went back to like, they were going to replace it for a couple thousand dollars. And it went to like, then give someone pause, maybe, that what they're doing is that something is more valuable than putting another stick in, or perhaps that something was irreplaceable.
I agree 100%. And then, you know, I've seen that be it's brought value to the trees. And I've seen that happen on numerous occasions in, you know, doing appraisals over the years and teaching the course here in Canada or in North America. But when I went to Hong Kong, it was very interesting, because as we valued the trees using the methodologies, they became a little nervous because they said, there's developers here that would think nothing of, and they were significant numbers. They weren't small values. But they said, this isn't enough to stop people here. And they were a little, you know, and we came to a conclusion, you know, it was the first tree appraisal.
Really?
Yeah, because they said the kind of money that exists, it's only $1 million? Oh, hell.
Oh, jeez.
We'll give you two. You know, and I was like, they're like, whoa, this is, and I said, you know, you guys really need to look at this. And it was the first appraisal course ever run there. You know, I said, you need to, you know, maybe this square peg isn't made for the round holes you guys got here. Like, don't think you have to follow this model exactly. And you have a lot of justification for developing, something different or new that's unique for this environment, because you have a lot of things that are different here, like we've been talking about. And I hope that's what, that you'll see the industry move towards there. And I said, they were all leaders and you know, part of municipalities and large organizations that are in a position to make that change. And I tried to inspire them to that effect. I said, you know, you are the people that are going to set the stage for how this is going to move forward. And you have every, not only right, but responsibility to do that. And I hope, and I encourage you to do that. And I said, whatever you figure out, please share it with us so we can learn from it too. And I hope that, and I think you'll see that. And maybe maybe we'll see that happening here, because exactly what we're talking about. But I've absolutely seen the valuing of trees and putting those dollar values to it. Give developers here pause rather than, oh, we'll just pay it. You know, so, and it was sort of like a backfire effect there they were afraid could happen. So I guess when money becomes no object, then appraisal needs to take on a different format. Because let's face it, if a tree's priceless, then money is no object. And we got to find something else to attach to it.
Yeah, it should just not even be part of the equation. You just can't do it, because those trees will, they'll never come back. Like, you just can't. Downtown, urban trees just won't grow like that ever again.
And I think we have to remember too, their climate and the species we're dealing with. Like, I can't say I would ever see an elm or a poplar or an ash do what some of these ficus do, and the way they'll grow over several hundred feet of stone and find little nooks and crannies and drill those little roots in there, and they'll get nutrients and withstand, you know, the buffeting of tires and wheels and all manner of man's onslaught. You know, like, they're a pretty wild trees. They're, you know, I don't know that our trees have the same, they're not made of the same stuff, so to speak. You know, those trees are incredible.
Yeah, they're pretty resilient.
It's a concrete that's alive flowing over other concrete pieces and swallowing it up almost, and then integrating it into their structure. Like that one on the corner there, that by the harbor, that's holding on to the rock, that huge ficus there, man.
Yeah, I have no idea how that thing was alive. I have no idea.
I know. It just is astonishing the way they find. I mean, there's soil underneath there somewhere, and they're finding it, right? Yeah, yeah. Wow, what an interesting foray into tree appraisal this has taken. That's excellent. I think it's a fascinating topic and subject. And you know, the other thing, Matt, which was interesting was, you know, your discussion there on biological controls and how that was a new thing. I was blown away by that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for such a progressive place and so much modernization of technology, yet they don't really have, they didn't, like, they currently aren't even using certain biologicals, or were they?
They don't really do, from what I can tell, my research, talking to people there. I mean, I think if I lived there for a while, I'd learn a lot more. But, you know, from what I could tell, they really weren't doing anything. And they were just kind of accepting decline of trees and shrubs as matter of fact. But you know, like what I was trying to put over to them was, you know, part of biological control is also cultural practices, and they were kind of aware of that, but some not really. And right. I found a lot of ways, so many of them were just, you know, I talked to so many brilliant arborists there, but and they're really educated, but in a lot of ways arboriculture is a totally new concept to them, the caring of trees. It's not, I mean, we're new to it in North America, right? But they're really new to it.
Yeah, when it comes to actually managing them or caring for them, or, you know, they've just been kind of coexisting rather than culturally existing with them. Yeah.
Yeah, they're doing some strange things, like to combat one of their Lepidoptera caterpillars. They were injecting some insecticide I never heard of, but they were inject, because the insect had four generations per year, they're drilling holes in the tree four times a year.
Wow. Well, I can't say that there hasn't been some drilling taking place over the years here in Winnipeg, least of all with the fight. The last stand against DED remains Winnipeg, I think.
I mean, even here, though, our drilling holes is innocuous because for DED, we drill them in the root flare every 3 years.
Yeah. But I mean, there's been various iterations over the years. So lots of trees have had experience. There's various, you know, there are methodologies, let's say, around drilling and DED control. Well, you know, it's interesting, Matt. We always get to about an hour, and it seems always like a natural segue, either biologically or just energetically, but,
Not that time. And I just want to thank you for taking the time and chatting with us. It's been a pleasure, and I've definitely given me pause to think about a few things. I'm fascinated to learn more about the Arbor Day event, and you know, I think that's you got something really unique there, and I think you should be proud of that. Everyone that's involved, not just yourself, but you know, when that type of synergy comes together and everyone starts working together for a common good and puts competitive differences aside, whatever the differences are, it's always refreshing, and everyone always benefits from that. So thanks for sharing that as well.
Yeah, everyone should come to Winnipeg's Arbor Day and learn. I don't know, we created a monster. I don't know, because if you ever come to it, it's a giant circus. It's a lot going on.
That's what it sounds like, and I'm strongly inspired to attend.
Oh, sounds like a lot of fun. Sounds like we got to take the old tree actions on the road and head to Winnipeg and check out.
Well, if you're ever training again in Winnipeg, Tony, look me up so we can get together.
Absolutely. They only tend to send me to Winnipeg though, like in the middle of winter. I don't know. Like I was fortunate; I got to come there when it was like reasonably warm last time. So I don't know. I got it in for me. But,